From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. What does it take to write 14 cookbooks? When I saw that Dori Greenspan had another gorgeous baking book hitting the shelves this fall, I wanted to ask her, what's the secret to being a successful recipe developer?
With baking, when I know that I want to make a recipe, that I want to create something, I'll write it first and I'll work from my notes, changing as I go along. It's so rare that anything is right the first time. And so I'll tweak and I'll rewrite. And I've got this little system where I put 3 stars next to a recipe when it's finished.
Dori's work ethic amazes me, and her recipes continually surprise and delight. When writing this last book, she asked, can there really be something new when it comes to chocolate chip cookies? And her answer, of course. It's always baking season here at Good Food, but there's something about the fall and winter months that finds the lure of the oven to be even stronger. So Dori Greenspan is back with a new batch of inspiration. Hello.
Hi, it's good to be back with you. Thank you.
You know, I should ask you, you had the opportunity to return to Paris after probably the longest time you've been away for many, many years, correct?
500 days. It was the longest time in about 20 years.
Wow. What was the first thing you ate that you didn't make yourself?
Oh, I know exactly what it was. An omelet. Because we got into Paris very early in the morning, went to the apartment and grabbed the little granny cart that I use when I've got a lot of shopping to do. And I prefer to call it the poussette rather than the cart. Michael and I went directly to a cafe and had an omelet.
That's a good way to begin.
It was, you know, but really, if you love a place that you're going to, there are so many good ways to begin. Usually just landing there is a good way to begin. But we did buy bread that day. We bought cheese. I bought some saucisson. I bought kind of what I consider the basics that I need to have my first day in Paris.
It's like picnicking at home.
It's like picnicking at home, yeah.
So because you mentioned the omelet, why don't we start talking about recipes from the new book with breakfast?
Okay.
What are a few twists that we can do with biscuits?
I did a bunch of things that were fun. I put instant potato flakes into biscuits. Years ago, I did a recipe they were like bunya, which is a fried dough from the Burgundy region of France. And to switch it up, I put potato flakes in it. And I realized there's such a good way of getting that flavor easily. And it seemed just right for breakfast. So I did that. I made blueberry biscuits where the blueberries are in the biscuit, which was fun to do. I used cottage cheese to make biscuits. Biscuits are basic. They're delicious, just traditional, classic, plain. But they kind of say, come on, you can do more. I'm willing. Bring it on. I can take it. And so they're really like scones and like muffins, fun to play with.
What does the cottage cheese do to the biscuit?
You know, it acts like the way buttermilk does or sour cream. So it, in flavor, you get some of that tang, not much. And it also tenderizes. It's a lovely biscuit.
Give us something else from your breakfasts, since it's something that you're revisiting after a long time.
So in most of the chapters in the book, I have a little section called sweethearts. And you'll know you've come to a sweetheart recipe because there's a sweet little heart there. These recipes, I didn't plan it this way. When I was finishing the book and putting recipes into chapters and seeing what I had, I realized that I had like mini collections of recipes. And one of them fell into the breakfast chapter. And it was brioche. So I love brioche. I was so proud of myself when I learned how to make it. And so in this book, I made babka, which might not be groundbreaking for other people, but I had never made a babka. This was my first time. So I made babka, and then looking at the babka, which was beautiful and delicious and really fun to make, I thought, it could be savory. And so I made little cheese swirly buns that are essentially savory babka.
Yum. That sounds delicious. Speaking of this kind of sweet and savory play, when do you decide to turn sweet on its head and make savory or salty versions of sugar-forward favorites?
So, shall I go on record as saying that I never had a list of recipes for this book? And this is my 14th book, but not the first time that I've just kind of baked and then looked at what I had and crossed my fingers that I had made a book. So it usually happens in process. It's usually when I'm working on something that I think, oh, I could flip this. There's a recipe for a miso maple loaf. Well, this one I actually came to directly through a circuitous route. This one came from a dinner that I made using miso and maple on salmon. And I tasted it and thought, I love these flavors together. And I think they could go into a cake. And the cake itself is kind of teeter-tottery. It could go either way. I think of it as sweet, but it has that slightly salty, slightly miso savory-ishness to it. And so it would go with cheese as well as jam.
You know, that was the first thing I made out of the book when I first got the galleys months ago now.
Right.
And I ended up toasting a thick slice of that, and it was fantastic.
So it really, it lends itself to toasting. I think, you know, I think I say in the recipe that if it goes a little stale, you can toast it. But you know what? The toasting really does bring out the flavors even when it's fresh. Good going, Evan.
Okay, so of course we have to talk about the chocolate chip cookie. What did you do that was new with chocolate chip cookies?
Well, so I have my classic chocolate chip cookie, which I've played with over the years. I've added cardamom, I've added coriander, I've added nuts, I've changed things. But I came back to my classic, not my classic, because I'm using more salt and more vanilla. And I'm not using chips, I'm using chunks. But the fun was taking the concept of the chocolate chip cookie and stretching it. So I have a cookie that I call one big break apart chipper. And it's a chocolate chip cookie. It has espresso and it has cardamom and it has cinnamon. You'll recognize it as a chocolate chip cookie, except you roll it out any way you want, kind of, you know, rough edged, higgledy piggledy, and you just bake it flat. And I love that you can cut it into beautiful little shapes if you want in the kitchen, but I don't. I usually just put it out and let everybody break off a piece. So it's really a shared dessert.
Well, once again, Dori, thank you so much.
I love talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Dori Greenspan is the author of 14 cookbooks. Her latest is Baking with Dori. We've got a recipe from the book on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, one of my favorite subjects, beans. How to make one pot, eat it for a week, and never get bored. And yes, we're going to talk about that side effect, too. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. We're told to eat whole grains for a nutritious and balanced diet, but there are so many. Are they all cooked the same, or do we need to learn dozens of different techniques? Abra Behrens is writer and chef at Graner Farm. Her experience as a farmer and chef in the Upper Midwest Great Lakes region of the U.S. gives her a deep focus working with grains, beans, seeds, and legumes of all kinds. Hi, Abra.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a delight. You know, it's so funny. Here in California, when we think of farmers, we think of people who tend row crops, you know, aka vegetables, or orchards, which means fruit. But so many farms in your area grow grains and legumes. How is that a different kind of farming?
I think it's a really important question that you're asking, because there's so many different types of farmers, and there's so many different sizes and scales and markets for farms. And so that was one of the things that I was thinking the most about with writing this book, is that Roughage, my first cookbook, was so much about my time growing vegetables on a biodiverse vegetable farm. And so as I was starting out with this book, was thinking, how are we going to make this a personal book for people who interacts with people who are growing these grains, because most grains and legumes are grown on much larger scale farms, you know, especially in the plain states where, you know, many thousand acres is not an uncommon site for someone to own and to grow. And so that's what I ended up hitting on, was to include a lot of those stories of people who are growing things that I've never grown before, such as rice, or, you know, what it means to really grow beans for a commodity market versus for a smaller community.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the surprises, I have to say, of cracking open your book, because the stories are very different from a lot that we hear about farmers. And I have to say, in particular, I was taken with the story of Carl Wagner, the seed cleaner. Could you tell us about him?
Yeah, I think that Carl, A, he's a good friend, and B, it was a revelation to me learning about his job. So I grew up on an industrial pickle farm, and so I sort of had a sense of the scale of farms. But what I didn't realize is how many hidden jobs or invisible jobs there are in these industries. And I think Carl's a perfect example of that, that, you know, when I had kind of a rough understanding of how a bag of flour, you know, comes to my kitchen, in that somebody grows wheat, it gets harvested, then you take the wheat berries out of the plant that most people are familiar with, and then it gets milled. Well, there's several steps in between that, and one of them is at Carl's place, which is where he's taking all of those wheat berries, which are threshed on the combine. So, you know, we harvest the whole plant, and then the combine separates the wheat berries out from the chaff that's holding it. And then in that mix, there's still lots of debris. There's lots of little bits of chaff. There's extra bran. You know, it depends on the type of wheat, what it's going to look like. There's weed seed. There's rocks. There's all of those sorts of things. And most farms no longer have the infrastructure on them to clean their own seed. So Carl got really fascinated with seed cleaning, which allows the farmers to have more control over where their seed is directed. So he's part of this sort of resurgence of the artisan grain chain. You know, if you're just dropping your wheat at a commodity grain elevator, they're going to do all of that cleaning there. It's going to get mixed with all of the other farms that are selling wheat to it. But with Carl, we're able to have the wheat that Grainer grows and have it cleaned in a single batch, so we know where it's going, if that's going to then go to get milled at a small mill like Meadowlark Organics or Janie's Mill, something like that, or if it's going to go to a brewery or a distillery or something like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let's talk about batch cooking, because I think that it's a way into so much of what you give us. You have these really interesting grids almost based on the phrase a week worth of blank without any boredom. Can you take us through one of those, maybe the black beans? It's like your basic black beans aren't that basic. So there you have you have a little bit of smoked paprika, some cumin seed, a little bit of chili flakes, and the beans.
Yes. And so I don't tend to put very many aromatic vegetables in, because I found that tends, if I don't have them, then I'm like, oh, I have to go to the store, I have to do this thing. And so I usually have the dried spices and I usually have the dried beans. The way that I do it is I, you know, like most spices, I will fry them off in a little bit of oil to bloom the flavor. And then add the beans and just plain water. I've almost completely stopped using stocks or broths to cook these ingredients, because especially with artisan grains and legumes, they're so flavorful that sometimes I felt like I was just tasting chicken stock over and over again. So I just use plain tap water to cook them. And then there's a lot of question about beans. Do you need to soak them in advance? Can you salt them? Can you use acid? I, in my research, has found that the average grocery store bean can have a shelf life of about, it's been off the plant for about 5 years, because they get mixed in these large factories and things like that. If you're using artisan beans that were grown, you know, within the last calendar year, oftentimes they're going to cook much more quickly, and they don't need to have the water to soak them to rehydrate them. The soaking is sort of an equalizer. And so I oftentimes kind of forget to soak them now. And so I'll just put the beans in and then cover them with twice as much volume of water. Bring it up to a boil, let them simmer until they're cooked. And then I still do tend to hold off on the salt until after they're cooked. I think it's an old habit from restaurant kitchens that I just haven't let go of yet, because they don't seem to toughen them if they're fresh beans, but I just still do it. So I wait until the beans are fully tender, and then I add salt to the liquid, let it dissolve, and then let the beans kind of steep in that really flavorful broth overnight. And I would probably eat them that night just like that, you know, with maybe some rice and a cabbage salad, or that would be day one of the week.
And then what happens on day two?
On day two, I would say that I would probably want beans for breakfast, especially black beans with those spices. You know, beans and a couple of tortillas and a little bit of cheese, maybe an egg for breakfast, or like a poached egg on top, and then some sort of, you know, kind of vegetable-y salad. I tend to eat a lot of weird salads for breakfast. So I would probably do that on day two. And then by day three, I would probably be getting a little bit fatigued. And so I might kind of use them more sparsely. So both of those first two ideas are really bean heavy. But then maybe by day three, I would want some like quesadillas or a grilled cheese sandwich, where I'm just going to kind of throw some beans in for texture and for a little bit of extra kind of oomph to a cheesy thing. But it's less about the beans as a whole and more about this other thing. And the beans are sort of have gone from a main, the lead role to a supporting role, if you will.
And then I just want to say that one of your suggestions is to use the pot liquor. And I think that the way you address pot liquor as an ingredient is just really, really smart, because so many of the beans that we're cooking these days have such a rich liquor that I find myself freezing it if I don't use it. So then I use it as a stock.
Yes. And so especially with these black beans or any sort of bean liquid, I find them to be the perfect base for a soup or something like that, just like you were saying with a stock. So for the black beans, I would probably like roast off some sweet potato and add that into the liquid. And there's going to be a few stray beans in there too, but it'll be kind of that really nourishing, warming liquid that's packed with that flavor. And then it kind of stretches it. So it's a totally different texture too, because you're not eating, you know, another bowl of beans. It's this like brothy kind of stew.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about beans. Can we talk about farts?
Yeah, that's, you know, chalk that up to a line that I was sure was going to get edited out and then was kept. And I was very, very excited about it.
So what is the process that causes beans to do this to us?
So there are carbohydrates in beans that we lack the enzymes to break down and to digest. And a carbohydrate is a type of sugar. And so that sugar will then feed the good bacteria that's in our gut. And the off-gassing of that activity manifests as gas, as farts. And so that needs to go somewhere. It needs to go out one way or the other. And there are ways to minimize it. You know, Joe Yonan wrote a wonderful book called Cool Beans, and he puts a little bit of kombu into the boiling liquid, which helps decrease it because it helps, you know, provide what we need to digest it. Lots of cultures often pair legumes with something fermented, which helps break that down. Things like beano can help with it. Asafoetida is another sort of home remedy for it. But I also think just eating them more often, your body starts to kind of figure out how to self-regulate.
So we have barely scratched the surface of this book. It is massive and it's fascinating and so useful. Thank you so much, Abra.
Oh, thank you for your interest and for your time. I really appreciate it.
That's Michigan-based chef, author, and former farmer, Abra Behrens. Her guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes is Grist. Monsanto. The chemical company with outsized influence and impact on our agricultural practices is often in the news. Its Roundup Ready seeds were introduced 25 years ago and have changed how many of us eat. With immense detail and care, historian Bart Elmore tells the troubling story of the company's past, present, and future. Hi.
Hello, Evan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So the amount of research you did is just extraordinary. Can we start with where Monsanto is right now in terms of any lawsuits and their fallout?
Absolutely. I never saw any of this that I'm about to tell you coming. It shocked me to the core as I was writing because I never anticipated it. Monsanto is no more because Monsanto was gobbled up by Bayer, the German life sciences pharmaceutical company, in 2018. And there's a certain irony there because when Monsanto was founded, the whole point of Monsanto was to be this American chemical company that would be independent of German firms like Bayer. And to your point, when that happened right after that merger, the first Roundup case, this is an herbicide that Monsanto created, Roundup, that was very popular, went to trial and the plaintiffs won. It was a $280+ million verdict, finding that a gardener who had been exposed to Roundup, that is cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, was linked to that. Subsequently, two other cases went against Bayer, with juries again finding that Roundup exposure was linked to those plaintiffs' cancers. And there has also been a series of other cases that have happened in the interim. Various states across the United States, Delaware, Washington, among many others, that have begun filing suit against Monsanto, now Bayer, for PCB contamination, another chemical that Monsanto produced decades ago that is still affecting folks even today. And then lastly, I should say there's another herbicide called dicamba that has been causing a lot of problems out in farm country. And there are farmers that are also filing suit against the company for that. And as a result, you know, Bayer's stock price has plummeted. And there's a real question as to what the future of this company is going to be, given all those liabilities. And in this case, when all those court decisions came down, many of the shareholders, who were German, issued a vote of no confidence against their CEO and the board of management because they were baffled. How is it that this company could have made the decision to buy a company with this extensive liabilities. That had never happened in the history of the DAX, the German exchange. So, you know, it's right in the book that Bayer, you know, Monsanto had always wanted to be separate from Bayer. It had wanted to be this American chemical company. But in some ways, the guy who started Monsanto, John Quinney, may have gotten what he wanted. He may have finally defeated this German firm because they've kind of swallowed a poison pill in a way.
It's such an odd story of a company. I feel like it grew up alongside the chemical industry since the very beginning of the 20th century. And it's sort of like a bellwether of poor decision-making in relation to externalities or unintended consequences.
Yeah, it was, you know, I really went into this knowing full well that a lot of people refer to Monsanto as Monsatan, you know, that it had this reputation. You could see it in polls as being listed as one of the most hated companies in history. And I really wanted to, as a historian, try and tell a human story as much as I could about, okay, well, what happened? And were people in this company just bad? Or are there stories of good people who were in the firm who are trying to create certain products that then have these consequences they didn't see coming? And I'll tell you that I saw both, really, in this story. You know, I think I saw well-meaning people. Bob Shapiro, who was the head of the company, I really believe he thought that some of the GMO seeds they would produce would feed the world and have these really outsized influences in a good way. On the other hand, I also found documents like one related to PCBs, where an executive sitting in 1969 in a confidential meeting deciding what to do about this toxic compound literally wrote in his own handwriting, "One of the alternatives, folks, is," and this is a quote from that document, "that we could sell the hell out of those PCBs as long as we possibly can, even knowing how toxic it was." And so, yeah, I definitely started to see that there was a kind of toxic culture at times within the firm in which really profits were held out as more important than people. Production lines were kept humming, even though they were clearly internally saying, "We're seeing problems with our compounds." And that was really deeply disturbing to come across. I remember when I saw that particular document, you know, it was jaw-dropping because sell the hell out of them. I mean, he went back and actually put in a little indentation to put the hell out of it. You know, it was not like it was an afterthought.
So let's go into the Wayback Machine. Who started Monsanto and when?
Yes. Well, Monsanto was started in 1901, right at the turn of the 20th century and going into the progressive era, by a guy named John Quinney, who was not a chemist and really knew very little about chemistry. He was a drug salesman who had come from Chicago to St. Louis. He was 40 years old when he started this company, naming it after his wife, Olga Monsanto. But, you know, he was 40 years old. He had two kids at the time. He was really somebody just struggling, trying to make it on his own. He had actually tried to build a factory in the late 19th century in St. Louis, and it had burned down. And you can see this picture of him in the book where he's got his family all around him. And I think, you know, he's not very happy. And part of that is, I think, the stress of the time. You know, he really wanted to strike it on his own. And I think that says something about the early years of Monsanto. There's a kind of haste, speed to the process, you know, trying to produce these chemicals as fast as you can, and at times at the expense of the workers. And I should say that the first products they made were ultimately saccharin, an artificial sweetener, and caffeine, of all things, which is how I came to the project, because I'd been writing a book about Coca-Cola. And I had been trying to trace the ingredients that go into Coca-Cola, and it brought me to Monsanto, because Coca-Cola was the sole buyer of all of Monsanto's saccharin and caffeine. Without Coca-Cola, there would really be no Monsanto.
That is just so mind-blowing.
It is. And, you know, it was weird to me because I didn't even know where caffeine came from, you know, and how did they even make the caffeine, which is how this whole journey started. I just wanted to understand how the chemicals that we just consume on a regular basis, you know, where they come from. And in that case, it was a bizarre story, and it ended up being waste tea leaves. So tea leaves that were left on the floor of tea exchanges around the world that Monsanto would sweep up as basically the garbage of the tea industry. And they realized, okay, nobody wants this stuff to actually drink the tea, but hey, it's got this drug in it, caffeine, that can be used as a stimulant. And sure enough, it became one of the most profitable product lines for them in the early years.
When did that happen? When and how did the company begin to really dig in, so to speak, to an agricultural product portfolio?
You know, they were so far behind the Europeans, especially the Germans, companies like Bayer that they were trying to beat. But the wars are really key, both World War I and World War II, because they cut off supplies of chemicals from overseas from these big powerhouses. And Monsanto, Dow, these other big chemical companies in the United States had an opportunity to grow in part because of war. So you could say that war really made these companies, that there's a connection between the chemical industries and war. And in a very direct way when it comes to agriculture. By the 40s, the U.S. military is trying to find various defoliants, herbicides that can be used to help troops, and particularly the Pacific Theater and other places where there are dense jungles. And one of the chemicals that comes out of that exploration is, or two compounds, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. These, incidentally, would become the key ingredients in what we know as Agent Orange that would be sprayed in the Vietnam War. And DDT was one of the other chemicals they were making at that time. They branded their DDT Santoban. So that's really the moment. These insecticides and pesticides are becoming a much bigger part of their portfolio by the late 1940s.
What about the ownership of plant genetics and their foray into seeds?
It comes much later, and I kept waiting for it. You know, the book's called Seed Money, and this company that's making chemicals in the 40s and not making a single seed, not owning a single seed company, is going to become the largest seed company in the world by the end of the 20th century and into the early 2000s. So how did that happen was one of the key questions of the book. I will say, going back to those chemical compounds I mentioned in the 40s, you know, by the 50s and 60s, it's very clear that these compounds are toxic. We know from the Vietnam War, by the end of the war, you know, veterans are exposing the public health effects of exposure to these chlorinated compounds. And Monsanto is actually trying to figure out, okay, how to make an herbicide that's not as toxic as Agent Orange. And thus is born in 1970 Roundup, this herbicide that was active ingredient glyphosate, that was a broad spectrum herbicide that could be sprayed on everything. And, you know, we think of Roundup now as being tied to all these court cases, according to the World Health Organization, potential links to cancer and things like this. But at the time, the whole point was that Roundup is the environmentally safe herbicide. And actually, Roundup becomes the first billion-dollar herbicide in history. It becomes this blockbuster product for Monsanto. And you're right, beginning in the 1980s, Monsanto begins really heavily investing in genetic engineering to see if they can create crops that can resist or tolerate heavy sprayings of Roundup or glyphosate. And basically, during the growing season, you could grow your crops, spray your crops. It wouldn't hurt your crops because they'd be genetically engineered to tolerate Roundup, but it would kill all the weeds. And Evan, the thing that was the most exciting thing from the archives was why? And the answer has a lot to do with the energy crisis. You know, if you look at the archives, as I did, I spent almost a decade doing this project, they say internally, 80% of what we make in the 1970s, 80% of all those chemicals, including a lot of these pesticides, were coming from petrochemical feedstocks, from natural gas and oil. And in 1973 and 74, you have this OPEC oil embargo. And then you have that Iranian hostage crisis and disruptions in the Middle East oil trade in 79. And the oil prices are through the roof. And they say internally, we couldn't keep going. I mean, we didn't have cheap hydrocarbons to make all these chemicals. Almost no company has done something like that, right? Totally revolutionized themselves in becoming this biotech company. But I'll emphasize that even as they did that, because they were so reliant on these billion-dollar brands like Roundup, they brought those chemicals into that biotech beyond. These would be genetically engineered seeds that were sold by Monsanto, but they would become packaged with their most profitable herbicide, Roundup. And that's what we started seeing in the 1990s.
What a story.
You know, what was really startling when I was writing about Roundup was I thought Roundup was going to be the really scary story, you know. But the other chemical that came up in those conversations internally with folks was dicamba, an herbicide that's being sprayed on farmland today, though many consumers probably don't know it. And this is an older chemical. It goes back to 1958. And it's been brought in to deal with weeds that have become resistant to Roundup. So we're now spraying a new herbicide, which is actually an old herbicide, to try and deal with those weeds, and it's called dicamba. And what happens when we spray dicamba is that it volatilizes, it vaporizes. So when you spray this chemical on a farm in hot temperatures, it jumps. That's what farmers will say. It actually will vaporize and then spread to farms nearby. Now, Monsanto is selling dicamba-tolerant seeds. So if you have dicamba-tolerant seeds, then your crops won't be affected. But if you don't buy Monsanto seeds, right, this vaporized herbicide can spread onto your farm and damage your farm. And some of the conversations I was having with my sources was about this chemical and about what was known internally about it. And I will say I went to the court case in Missouri where farmers who were hit by this vaporized herbicide were filed suit against Monsanto saying, how could you do this? And as I sat in the gallery watching that court case, my jaw dropped as the internal documents were released. I had been studying this and I said, well, wait a minute. Did they talk internally about the fact that this herbicide could jump, that is, spread off target and hit other farmers and make those other farmers feel like they need to buy dicamba-tolerant seeds? And sure enough, you know, there's these internal emails that were released in the trial in which they said, you know, we can sell protection from your neighbor as a way to sell these dicamba-tolerant seeds. This was another one of those moments where you said, that's not right, you know? That's not right to have a system where you know the product's going to do something like that, and it's going to force compliance, in a sense, with your seed system. And it really took me back when I was sitting there in that court case.
Wow, what a book. Thank you so much, Bart.
Thank you so much. This was truly a pleasure.
Bart Elmore teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State University. His book, Seed Money, chronicles the past, present, and future of Monsanto and its influence on our food system. In a minute, a gorgeous new book marries California produce with the spice blends and techniques of the Gujarati kitchen. We hear from the author of Mumbai Modern when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. California cuisine and ingredients have been the source of inspiration for many chefs. When married to global cuisines, the results are like the head exploding emoji: flavorful, aromatic, delicious. With her roots in India and her current home base in the Bay Area, recipe developer Amisha Gurbani brings a modern flair to time-honored Indian dishes. Hi, Amisha.
Hi, Evan.
Mumbai Modern is such a fascinating book. Where in India are your family roots, and where did you grow up?
So my family roots, as in my grandparents, hail from Gujarat. My maternal grandparents came from a town in Gujarat called Jamnagar, and my paternal grandparents came from a very small village called Dichra. I'm originally from Mumbai. My mom, she was actually born in Uganda, in Kampala. That's because my maternal grandparents, they got married and they moved from Bombay. They moved to Africa for my grandfather's business. And that's where all the siblings, my mom and her siblings, were born, in Uganda. And because of the expulsion that happened in the late 1960s, they all migrated back to India. But my grandmother and my mom's siblings, they all migrated to the UK. So there has been a lot of migration that happened in my family. But my mom stayed back in Mumbai because she got married to my dad.
And throughout all this migration, was the cooking going on in various houses still very Gujarati-based?
Yes, it was very Gujarati-based. And actually, in Africa, there was a huge Gujarati population because a lot of business people were going to Africa for their business. So there's a lot of influence for the Gujaratis in Africa of African ingredients like peanuts and coconut. And you'll see that running through my book as well and a few of the recipes. And actually my aunt, my mom's sister, she was gracious enough to share her recipe, which is, again, a very African influenced in the book as well. It's a corn-based curry with coconut and peanuts in it. Very delicious.
Your book opens up with a preserving chapter, lots of jams and other preserved things, which is really interesting and unusual because usually those kind of chapters are towards the back of the book. But I have a sense that this was your way into a culinary life, wasn't it?
It was. So when my kids were little, they started going to preschool, and one of the things that we would give to them was PB&J. And I did not like the jams off the shelf. They had too much sugar. The color was not the beautiful, bright color of the fruits that it's supposed to be. So I started making jams at home and using less sugar and more fruit. And it was just so flavorful. And they started enjoying it. I started doing flavor combinations of jams where I would do I had a strawberry chocolate jam, which my kids loved at that age, 2 and 4. That was one of the first flavor jams that I developed, and then went on to flavors like peach and ginger. And those are not flavors that you usually find in the market or something that you think your kids might enjoy, but because they were used to eating it from a young age, they just loved it. And it just became a way of life. I wanted to put it in the first chapter because I believe it's like a pantry staple, that I wanted to showcase how I can use jams to make other things other than just toast or PB&J. So I have jams that I've used to make breakfast rolls. I have jams that I use in macarons. So I just wanted to showcase how I can use jams in other things as well.
You actually went to school to learn dough lamination so you could make these at least unbelievable looking danishes, both sweet and savory, that are throughout the book.
Yes, yes, I did. I took a lamination course at the San Francisco Cooking School. It's one thing I was intimidated by for some reason, and I wanted to overcome that fear. So it's something that I go with throughout my life. If something intimidates me, I want to tackle it. So that's what I did. And surprisingly, it was so easy. And it was such a therapeutic process to make lamination dough. And if anyone has not tried it, it's something that you have to try. You get into this zen moment when you're laminating the dough and just creating those layers of butter and flour. And then when you see the final product and you see all those flaky layers coming right out of the oven, it's just pure joy. I'm just like screaming in the kitchen once the end product comes out of the oven. And just having that with coffee or my masala chai or the kids enjoying it, it just brings me joy.
So you just used the word masala in the context of a chai masala. I'm wondering if you could share a couple of your spice blends or masalas with us that we may not have heard of before.
So Thandai masala is one of my favorite, absolute favorite masala blends that I have been using and making from scratch for years. It literally takes 15 minutes to make. It's got about 10 spices. I know it sounds like a lot, but it's just a matter of putting it together in a high-speed blender or a coffee blender, and then the end result is this absolutely aromatic, sensuous masala blend, which is crazy delicious, and I've used it in many different ways. I actually package it and give it to friends and family for any occasion like Christmas or Diwali or any of those big festivals, and everybody loves it. It consists of like dried rose petals, whole spices like cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, black peppercorn, and then it has nuts such as pistachio, almonds, cashews, poppy seeds. So that's about it. I think it's about 10 spices in it.
And what would we use it for?
So the masala blend, I've used it to make these beautiful Thandai shortbread cookies, which is in my book. You can just use it to make popsicles, like infuse it with milk and heavy cream and make popsicles out of it. They make for a very festive popsicle, actually. I've used them to make Linzer cookies, actually, with a strawberry rose jam in the middle. And it tastes really beautiful, very fragrant and floral and aromatic.
Oh, sounds so wonderful. So one of the things that I found really interesting that you talked about in Mumbai Modern is how Mexican and Indian cuisines overlap. Can you talk a bit about that and how you navigate that in your own kitchen?
Yeah, I love Mexican cuisine, especially because I feel we have so much similarities in terms of slow cooking, cooking with love, putting, you know, steps into cooking, and just the amount of flavor and texture that goes in the food. They use a lot of dried red chilies, which is used a lot in Indian cooking too. And the dried red chilies, they have different kinds of dried red chilies, and so does Indian cuisine. They have their flatbread, which is the tortilla, and we have our flatbread called the rotli, and naan and parathas. There are all these different kinds of flatbreads that we have. And it's always filled with something delicious. The food is not bland, and I just feel like you can up the level of spice in Mexican cuisine, similar to Indian cuisine. It doesn't have to be spicy to enjoy it. But if you want it spicy, you could make it spicy and enjoy it. So I find a lot of similarities between the two and love incorporating Mexican spices in my cuisine.
Also, there's a dish in which I don't remember if it was your mother or an aunt that had a flour tortilla hack. The Dahi Papdi Chaat?
Oh, yeah, the Dahi Papdi Chaat. That's the cover of the book. It's my mother-in-law. So she came to this country in the 1970s. And they were from Pune in India. And she landed in San Diego for the first time. There were no Indian stores. And she didn't know how to recreate these dishes at home. You know, you long for those flavors when you're away as an immigrant for the first time in the country, especially in those days when you had no family or friends around. And food is what brings you together. Food is invokes memories and sort of keeps you going, especially when you make your own food from your own culture. So she came up with this hack of using tortilla, and she would fry it to resemble the papadis, which is actually just whole wheat flour fried. And after my husband and I got married, she would make it for us in the same way that she made in the 1970s. And I loved it. And I thought I had to include this part of her culture, her hack, and her tradition into the book, because it still speaks to the immigration culture and how coming to a different country, you're trying to find your way through. And she found a way through this tortilla hack.
Well, thank you so much, Amisha. It's a really fascinating book. And the stories that you tell throughout bring us into this world that you've created.
Oh, thank you so much, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Amisha Gurbani is a computer engineer, recipe developer, and the creator of The Jam Lab. Living in the Bay Area, she combines her roots with California ingredient inspiration in her cookbook, Mumbai Modern. The Market Report is on deck. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. And now for some more California inspiration, let's head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where a beloved vendor has returned after a long absence.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. There is a familiar face back at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market this week. Megan Strom, who's the co-owner of County Line Harvest, is here after a long, long absence. Megan, it's great to see you.
Good morning. It is so great to be back.
So you always take a little bit of time off every summer. Was this summer the same as years past?
So we always wrap up our farm season in Thermal in June, and then we transfer our growing season up to Petaluma in Marin County. And this is the first time in 21 years that we weren't able to farm up there because of the drought. Our irrigation water all comes from rainwater catchment, and we just did not get enough water over the winter, so we were forced to take a break.
Wow, so that means that no seeds went in the ground this year up there?
Exactly, yeah. Our ground will be fallow for an entire year.
And what are you hearing from your neighbors up there? I mean, we had that great deluge recently. Do you know if the reservoir is filled back up?
It is filling. Yeah, it's at 12 feet now, which is great. We need one to two more storms like that in order to put us over the edge to feel comfortable farming next summer.
Okay, so when will you start planting again if all goes as planned?
Hopefully in April or May. We usually do our baby lettuces over the summer. One thing that'll be missing from the market this year, unfortunately, because of the Petaluma drought, is our chicories that we're really well known for. We did plant in Thermal, so that'll be an experiment. We direct seeded some of our Italian heirloom varieties, and we're also putting some transplants in. So stay tuned to see if those work out. They should be here in January or February.
How does the heat of the day down in the desert affect the winter vegetable crops, which are used to maybe a colder climate?
So the crops that benefit the most from it are the ones that you want to be spicy. So our red frill mustard, our arugulas are really peppery and hot right now. We also don't wash them. They're hand harvested and packed in the field, which means that they're going to really pack a punch with the flavor. Some of the winter vegetables that you want to be sweeter for us taste better after you see our first frost, but the arugulas and the mustards really benefit from the heat.
Awesome. Well, Megan, it's wonderful to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Megan Strom, co-owner of County Line Harvest. She is bringing up her vegetables from Thermal, California at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market and will soon be back Sunday Mar Vista and Saturday at the Pico Market. Now that it's November, we can finally start talking about Thanksgiving, and I'm very happy to have Valerie Gordon of Valerie Confections here with me to make sense of how to turn all of the beautiful winter squash at the market into delicious Thanksgiving desserts. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Jillian. How are you?
I'm good. I have been eagerly awaiting this conversation. So you are offering not one, but two pumpkin desserts this time of year. What do you have on the menu?
We are. We got really ambitious this year. We're doing a pumpkin pie, and it's the same pumpkin pie that we have served for probably the last decade, although we always switch up the squash depending on what's available. But new this year, and this is an exciting one, we're doing a pumpkin Basque cheesecake that you get a side of creme fraiche whipped cream. And just because, you know, who doesn't want a little whimsy, we're doing these candied spiced pepitas that you sprinkle over the top for some, a little heat, a little texture, some good crunchy business.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when we're making these with fresh pumpkin, are you using the same pumpkin for both desserts?
I am using the same pumpkin for both desserts. And, you know, the flavor is just completely different when you roast your own pumpkin. Yeah. But this year we're using the Futsu from Tutti Frutti. Mm-hmm. And Barbara is, you know, at their booth at the Hollywood Farmers Market, at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And she was like, Valerie, the Futsu is really, really good this year. And I was like, hot. That's the direction we're going then.
It's a great pumpkin. It's got some nice thick walls. You can also stuff it for a savory application. For the sweet, to make the puree, what's your process?
The process is actually really, really simple. And it is one of those things that I wish more people did because it's not a huge time suck at all. What you do is you slice it in half and you've got to use a pretty heavy, sharp knife and a really stable cutting surface. You cut it in half. You scoop out the seeds, and then I place it open side down on a parchment-lined baking sheet. And then you want to bake it for a really long time, like a good 2 hours at about 350, depending on your oven. But you want to bake it until it's incredibly soft to the touch. So if there's any rigidity in there, throw it back in. So this is like one of those great things you can do when you're, you know, watching a show on Netflix, when you're doing something like that. If you're, I mean, so many people are still working from home. It's about 5 minutes of active time to get it into the oven. Then when you pull it out, you let it cool to room temperature, and then you just put it into a food processor and turn into puree, and that's it. I don't add anything to it.
Wow, and you don't have to peel it.
No, because peeling is horrible, right? Like, that is full-on purgatory. Nobody wants to steal, and you, like, break your peelers. Don't bother. So you get it out. It's super soft, right? You let that come to room temperature, and then really the skin almost just comes right off. There's no work in that part.
Okay, and then once it goes through the food processor, you've got this puree. What do you add to it for both your pumpkin pie and the Basque cheesecake?
So I don't add anything to the puree. So it's really a one-to-one recipe. It's the same amount of weight or volume as you might use for your standard canned pumpkin recipe, but you get substantially better flavor, texture, and color, particularly with this futsu.
And let's talk about spices. So what do you gravitate towards?
So I'm sensitive to the overuse of cinnamon in most desserts. And so I really like to blend spices. Throw in some nutmeg, a little ground ginger, a wee bit of ground white pepper, and a little bit of clove. So I like to mix it up and do a spice blend rather than just cinnamon in a dessert, for sure. For the Basque cheesecake, there's a little bit more ginger. Because the Basque cheesecake is so fat forward, I mean, a Basque cheesecake essentially has heavy cream, eggs, tons of cream cheese, sugar, and pumpkin. I wanted a little bit of that natural heat to really balance out the substantial fat that's going on there. And then, of course, we're topping it with the creme fraiche whipped cream. So, because it's the holidays.
It sounds amazing. Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you, Jillian.
That was Valerie Gordon of Valerie Confections. You can pre-order her Thanksgiving desserts by going to valerieconfections.com. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, Kenny Ng, and Nick Lamponi. I'm Evan Kleiman. My mind is turning to pie. How about yours? I'll be back next week with another episode of Good Food.